Hello listeners and welcome to this week's episode of The Cult Vault. Today we have another instalment of Pentecostalism. This episode focuses on the difficulties of trying to leave a movement when your loved ones have so much influence over your community and your life. This episode has some difficult themes, so discretion is advised. But for now, here is Courtney and her story of being involved with the UPCI. Courtney, and welcome to the podcast. Thank you for agreeing to talk with me today. This is going to be the second installment of Pentecostal coverage that I'm doing over January, and it's the second of three parts, so I'm excited to have another section to add to this overall religion. Would you like to start by introducing yourself to our listeners and telling them a little bit about who you are?
My name is Courtney Fletcher. I am 37 years old, and I'm from Louisiana. I grew up in the United Pentecostal Church, and yeah, that's it.
So UPCI, is that how they abbreviate that? Okay, and
yeah.
It's my understanding that that's the biggest branch of Pentecostalism in terms of number of members involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And is it a big movement in the area that you grew up in?
I grew up in a small town in central Louisiana. And there's a very large church there. There's a lot of very tiny churches all over Louisiana. It was very, and still is, all over the state.
And is it sort of, when you say there's small churches all over the place, are they churches practicing different parts of Christianity mostly?
Some of them are stricter than others. But they're all similar in the foundation of what they believe. Some of them can get a little bit more strict, but basically it's all the same.
Okay. And is this a movement that you were born into, or is it something that you naturally became a part of?
No, I was born into the church.
Okay. And your mum and dad, they met through their church gatherings or outside of the church?
I believe they met at church.
Okay.
So sides of my family were in church.
Okay. And do you have brothers or sisters?
I have one sister that's from both parents, and then I have a half brother, and then I have a stepbrother and sister.
Okay, so your parents, are they from marriages before you arrived, or are they from marriages since?
No, I'm the firstborn from them. They got divorced when I was 12, so that's why we have kind of a mix of having half brothers and sisters, stuff like that.
Okay, so do you remember much about what happened around their church involvement during their divorce? Because I know that that's something that members who practice a form of Pentecostalism find quite difficult to go through a divorce and the prospect of remarrying and that being a sin.
Right. So I was 12 when my parents got divorced, and it was not common for other people to be doing. I don't think it's common now. But I can remember losing friends, you know, like, my friends weren't really allowed to hang out with me as much because my parents were getting divorced.
Okay.
Some of my family members were on the board of the church, and my grandmother is pretty well known. She was kind of one of the founding people of a very large church. And her and my grandfather got married. She started singing in the church when she was very young. She was about 13, I believe. And so that's kind of how they all kind of started in it. But I don't know. My grandmother, my family's on the board, and my grandmother. So I don't know.
So there's deep family involvement that goes back through generations in terms right. of involvement with the church up until today. And is it your mum, do your mum and dad still practice separately their faith?
Yeah, my dad now lives in Wisconsin. Okay. That's kind of a recent new development in the last few years. My mom still lives in central Louisiana. She still goes to the church there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what about your brothers and sisters? Are they all still involved sort of in church activities, or have they withdrawn like you have as well?
So my sister, me and my sister don't really talk, but me and my sister, when the last time we connected, she was out of the church.
Right.
And then my half brother, he's with my stepmom and my dad. And,
right.
So he's definitely in there. My stepbrother and sister, this is a little bit of a weird thing, but when my mom remarried, she remarried a man that was not in the church, and right. he converted.
Oh, he did? Okay.
He converted, and he and his kids are not in the church. I mean, they did go, like, they went to services, and they kind of loosely followed the rules, but they were never, like, held to that same standard as we were. So yeah,
when you're growing up and you are introduced to these new members of your family, and mm-hmm. you realize that you were going to be treated differently to how they were in terms of their involvement with the church and stuff, do you think that affected your ability to bond with them in any way?
I mean, it was very hard. You know, and when it was like in the moment of it, you don't really know what you're doing. And I think that I was probably really mean to them because it wasn't fair, you know, mm-hmm. and I had fought for so long, you know, I started asking questions at a very young age. And I didn't like wearing skirts every day. And I still don't. To this day, ever since I've left, like I rarely ever wear dresses or anything like that. And so it just wasn't, I just felt like it wasn't fair. And I felt like, you know, they had a little bit more freedom. And I felt like they had all these opportunities to do all these things that me and my sister didn't get to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it just it made me mad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think it was sort of strange for them not really understanding the church or the faith as well, to hear about, you know, your church activities and involvement in the church and things like, you know, speaking in tongues and that sort of thing?
Oh yeah, I'm sure. And that's the other thing, you know, like growing up in that, you don't realize that it's not normal, you know, until you bring someone else around it. And then they're like, what in the world is going on? You know?
Yes.
And, you know, and so by the time my mom got remarried, I pretty much knew that I was going to leave. And so when they became our siblings, I pretty much was already kind of mentally out.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of already trying to just get out of there.
Yeah, yeah.
At that point.
Do you think being introduced to them and seeing sort of, quote, unquote, their worldly lives, so to speak, was kind of like an extra motivational push for you to make that decision to finally sort of say, you know, there are more experiences that I mm-hmm. want in life?
I definitely think it added to it. You know, there was a lot of factors in me leaving, but I think it definitely like solidified it. Like it just validated a lot of things for me. Like, okay, so I have to follow all of these rules and I have to like give my entire life to this belief, these beliefs that I don't even really believe in or understand. But my mom and my parents can do all these things that are like royally wrong, you know, and they can do whatever they want, but I have to like wear a skirt every day and I have to, you know, and I can't do that. And I think that was what it was for me. It was like, well, why do you get to do this and I can't? Or why is it okay for you and it's not okay for me? Or why is it okay for them? Like, why is it okay for my siblings to do this? And why, like, it was just so many contradictions.
I imagine as well that you, you know, at times where you were feeling more certain in your faith than others, was there ever a time where you were worried for their souls as well, because they weren't going to the church and, you know, and, or maybe not so much yourself, because I know you questioned everything from such a young age, but people that are, you know, people that really truly believe in their religion and their faith, do you think they would worry for their siblings at this point who aren't going to the church and who won't be saved?
Are you saying you think they're worried about me?
Or? No, would practicing church members. So say that I'm from the UPCI and I really believe all the scripture, you know, everything the pastor tells me, everything that I'm told is gospel. And then I have these new step siblings. And they're not going to the church. And I think to myself, well, what's going to happen to them? Because if they don't have God, then the terrible things are going to happen to them, you know, when the end of days comes.
Mm-hmm. I never had those feelings. And it's funny that you asked me that, because like now I'm thinking about it and like, I never felt those feelings for them. Like I can remember vaguely in like, 7th grade, like I was living in Monroe and I was going to this school, and I can just remember looking around and being like, all of these people are going to hell, and like being worried, but then later just being like, that's not, none of that's real. And like that thought has always stuck out in my head, like,
yeah,
just remembering like looking around me being like, are all these people going to hell? Like, is that real? Like, you know, and I think that's when I really started to like really question it. But yeah, I didn't really have those feelings whenever I got the new siblings. Like, I don't know. I just never, it was more of like, okay, they have a different set of rules than you, but it was like an unsaid thing.
Yeah. 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 And you mentioned there that you know, would look around and in 7th grade and have these thoughts about your peers. So I'm guessing that you weren't homeschooled. You went to public school?
Yeah. So because I guess because I went to such a large, the church in the city that I was in, I guess it was so big that, or large that, that we had like a big community at school.
Okay.
So it was easier, I guess, for them to control, because there were so many of us. So it was easier for us to all go to public school. We definitely had girls in our friend group that like there were days or whatever, for whatever reason we were fasting. And we were all supposed to be fasting with the church, and like a few of us ate and like definitely got shamed for that at school. 4 days, for however many days they were fasting, like I can remember that. I can definitely remember like trimming my hair, like the very ends of my hair, and like getting called out for it, like at school. Like, so I don't know like how it was. I don't know how it was for like people in smaller, tinier churches. I think that they do a lot of homeschooling. I know that there's like a few, I know there's like some Christian schools that are more friendly to them, that they like to put their kids in those schools, and those are like private schools.
Mm-hmm.
So I know they do that. But yeah, so I did go to public school, so I was a little bit out exposed.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of those early experiences, you know, sort of rite of passage experiences, I guess, you were able to have to some capacity, even if you were constantly almost monitored by your peer group. And were these discretions at school reported back to the pastor in the church as well?
Oh, I'm sure. And I mean, that's the other thing, like the church is so big, and that pastor is so glamorized that he doesn't have time to bother with little old me that wants to wear pants to school, you know, like that's just how, that's kind of the attitude there. And I mean, my family and that family are close. And so maybe he might have had a little bit more time for me, but there's so many members that he doesn't really have time to give, you know, full attention. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
So he's not going to get, I mean, in tinier churches that I did attend, the pastor would get up there and like point out and say, you know, like mm-hmm. this person.
Yeah. That's just what I was about to say. Cause, the other ex-Pentecostals that I've spoken to have mentioned how the pastor almost micromanages the congregation, because there's really not that many people to oversee, so to speak. And in school, a lot of members that attended public school found it quite ostracizing, because they would they would dress differently. One person mentioned wearing long sleeves and pants to go to the lake when everyone was kind of taking their tops off to go swimming, and wearing their bathing suits and things like that. And then, you know, children pick up on those things and notice those differences and almost stigmatize, children for those differences, or for things that they don't fully understand, you know, because they're not exposed to those things. So it's interesting to hear your perspective on how, you know, it's almost like the pastor doesn't need to micromanage to maintain that level of control, because the kids are all doing it for him when they're all kind of shaming you for eating and trimming your hair.
Right. Yeah. And that's how it is there. And like, I did, because of my parents' divorce, I did move, because my dad moved away after the divorce. My dad moved to Monroe, and then he moved to Lake Charles. And then he lived in Shreveport for a long time. So I've lived and gone to other smaller churches. And that is definitely a thing. There's a church in Lake Charles that the pastor gets up there and calls on the younger people in the church to stand up and testify.
Right.
That's, I feel like a tool of like his way of like controlling, and it's almost like you better be on your toes because you might get called on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, I've seen that, you know, and it's scary. And I've been in those services like, oh my gosh, please don't call on me. Like, what am I going to say at 13 or 14 years old?
Yeah. You know? And it, I think it's that fear that keeps a lot of people from straying or, you know,
mm-hmm. they don't want to be embarrassed.
Yeah, exactly. So when you were growing up in the church, what was the average day or week like? Because obviously your family have quite strong involvements in the mm-hmm. church. And I'm sure that at a certain point, some of that fell onto you as well, you know, to be the next generation of really involved mm-hmm. children of the church as well. So what was an average day and week like for you in terms of church involvement?
We had something to do at church just about every day of the week.
Okay.
You know, whether it was prayer meeting, whether it was church, whether it was, you know, youth activities, all of my friends, you know, all of my friends went to church. Any outside of school activity was church related. The church that I went to, they put on a very big production every year. So I was part of that.
Okay.
It was like an Easter production and I was part of that. So like I can't really remember when we would start practices for it, but it was a pretty big thing.
Okay.
That they put on, I mean, it was kind of wild how they pulled off such a big thing, mm-hmm. but yeah. So.
I mean, if you have that many members of the congregation and they're willing to, you know, true. Donate so much of their time, to church activities, then I'm sure there are some spectacular things that can be accomplished. It's interesting. I would be interested. I would like to sit down and watch one of these.
That's on. They have it. I can send you the.
Yeah,
the
absolutely. Info. Please do that. And I can put it in the notes for any of the listeners that would be interested as well, because so many people I speak to say we had a production each year and it would be like this and it would be around Easter time. So I just wonder what these productions are like.
Actually, and when Bill Clinton was president, he actually came to it. I mean, he was like, he came, I don't know. I don't remember how old I was. Maybe I was like 10, but Bill Clinton came and they had the Secret Service in there. It was wild.
And wild. Is that because he is a practicing member of PCI, or is it just because you were the biggest church in the area with the biggest congregation?
I think he has a relationship with the pastor.
Okay.
And he like the part of like my two of my aunts went and sang at the inauguration.
Okay.
You can look it up, but the pastor's wife of the church sang at the inauguration, so they kind of have a relationship, and mm-hmm. then he came and saw the production, so
mm-hmm. interesting. I'm sure if there's any conspiracy theorists or QAnon listeners,
oh god, I can't wait.
Yeah, that are listening are probably shouting, you know, protect the children.
I can't wait to hear it.
So in terms of, you know, to put on this kind of level of show, there must have been fundraising or pledging or something encouraged for you know, for to be able to bring money into the church.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they would always do the offering in the, you know, on Sundays and everything, and then They do different like donation type things. They like to talk about donating to missions. That's a really big thing. They like to and then for that particular production I just talked about, they sell tickets.
Right.
To it. They sell tickets to that. They do bake sales. And, you know, because the church is so large, you know, when they do anything, it's, you know, a big thing.
Yeah. And yeah. Bringing in lots
successful.
Of money.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And what about things like propaganda and recruitment? Are they always looking for ways to bring new members in?
Yeah. So when I was growing up, my dad was pretty involved in bus routes at one particular church. Him and my stepmom would go and they would pick up kids like in low-income neighborhoods, and they would bring them to church. You know, that was always kind of pushed on me that we, you know, anyone that we spoke with, anyone that we came in contact with, if we didn't witness to them, then their blood was basically on our hands if they went to hell, and we were responsible for their souls.
Yeah.
You know, that's
what
we're taught.
And I think that's some of the types of ostracizing, things that other people have spoken about, you know, when they attempted to witness to other children at school who were, you know, part of a different faith or from, you know, atheist backgrounds and stuff, who would find it, you know, quite intimidating almost to have somebody come and tell you that you're going to burn in hell unless you listen to what we have to say.
Right.
And as a child, if that's what you're told, if that's what you're taught, if that's, you know, what you believe, because that's what you've been told to believe from such a young age, of course you're not going to see anything intimidating or wrong with that. You're just telling them the truth and how things are and how it is, you know, that's what's going to happen. You're going to burn in hell. So it's always a difficult one when you talk about children and how children are influenced in these types of movements. And you mentioned briefly, you know, that now you rarely wear skirts and dresses and things like that. So I know modesty is a big part of most of the branches of Pentecostalism. So clothing is part of that modesty. I'm sure it's the same with what you wear on your upper half as well. Like, you know, no cleavage. What about shoulders and clavicles and things like that?
It's very much like, you know, sleeves need to be to the elbow. If you're on the platform for any reason, like if you're in choir, if you're in the choir, or if you're involved in any reason to be sitting on the platform and having people look at you, you have kind of a stricter rule, you know, like on Sundays, if you're on the platform, you have to wear your hair up. You have to make sure that your skirt is long. You can't wear a short skirt to your knee, really. You know, like there's a little bit of a stricter thing when you're sitting on the platform.
Right. Okay.
You know, but yeah.
Why is that? Is that because when God's going to look at the platform more than he's going to look at everybody else?
It's like, I guess, because you're being seen, you know, you have to make sure that. Because they are very much about image, you know, they're very much about image. They're very much about what other people see and how people see it. And that's, you know, one of the very foundations of their cult is that, you know, they're very, very worried about what other people think about them and how they're seen, which is really weird to me, because if I see any of them out like in public, they're rude, you know, or they all look miserable. When you see them out in public, they look miserable. And it's just like, so it's just interesting to me that it's that way. But,
and do you think you can instantly spot somebody who is a member of the UPCI?
Oh yeah.
That's interesting. Oh, yeah. That's really interesting. I was speaking to a friend the other day in America, and he said, It's easy to go shopping on a Sunday because I can stay away from anyone wearing a suit because he's got a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses in his area. So he knows that on a Sunday, if he sees someone out wearing a suit, they are most likely, you know, pioneering after their Sunday service. So that's also interesting. What about things like food? You know, are you kind of encouraged to eat a certain way, or employment and training and things like that? Are you encouraged to take up certain types of jobs?
Food, I don't know. Food was always a weird thing with me. Like I was always a very, very, very picky eater for some reason. I don't know if that has anything to do with church. My little brother was the same way. I've gotten a lot better with it now and I eat pretty normally. But I don't know if that has anything to do with anything.
Mm-hmm.
As far as jobs go, that's one of those unsaid things of like, you know, your parents kind of push things on you. They don't tell you like, this is what the plan is, but it's kind of like, this is what, you know, what your parents are, you know, what your parents are aspiring for you to be, you know, like, you know what your parents want you to do. They don't have to tell you they want you to be a preacher's wife. Like, you know, that's the dream,
right?
You know what the dream is, you know, my parents never had to tell me that, but you know, there were certain boys like that my mom would like encourage me to talk to, or right. like, you know, stuff like that. And like, so as far as jobs go, like my parents never really set me up to even think about what I wanted to be like when I grew up, like a doctor. And I was never set up past high school.
Right.
You know, like they didn't have a plan for me really after that. It was just like, you're going to date all these people and you're just going to be in church mm-hmm. until you get married. You know, that was the plan. I never had a plan past that.
And you're talking to me now and I can see that you've got lovely red hair, which I'm guessing is not something that would have been encouraged when you were in the church.
No.
So is the red hair, is that sort of kind of just how you like having your hair, or do you find yourself doing things now that you're out of the church that you might not have necessarily been able to do whilst you were in the church?
I don't know. I think I've already gone through my phase of like, you know, rebellious and yeah. like, you know, my hair girl told me that I would look good with red hair. One of my aunts had red hair growing up and it was really pretty on her. So I, went for it.
And that's okay, because you could just do that now. You could just go pick up some hair dye and just kind of make it whatever color, and that's fine.
Yeah.
Awesome. So you mentioned briefly about your mum encouraging you to talk to certain boys, and you know, and that you would be expected to just date different people until you got married after the high school. So I know that all the listeners are going to know the answer to this question already. But I'm guessing your mum wouldn't have encouraged you to speak to girls you might be interested in spending time with.
No.
And is that because the UPCI kind of strays away from LGBTQIA+ inclusion?
Yes.
And what's your personal experience around that?
So, my parents, you know, I knew that I liked girls growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that I was attracted, but I was very confused about it because I also liked men, you know, in a different way. And mm-hmm. so, and I didn't understand it growing up, and I just thought it was a perversion, and I thought that I thought it was the devil, you know, mm-hmm. and I thought it was just temptation, and that was how the devil was trying to get me to stray away. So that was definitely a thing for me growing up, and I had to deal with that completely alone because I couldn't talk to my parents about any of that.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't even know, like, I didn't know what anything was until later, you know, a lot later than my friends. But, you know, I knew that at a young age, but I just kind of like tried to pray it away, I guess. And I guess it was easier for me than it is for other people that have gone through this because I was able to hide it.
Right.
Because I like men. So I can be in a relationship with a man and be happy. So it was easier for me. I had it a little bit easier because when you say, when you come out as a gay man, I mean, women, it's bad for them. I mean, women in that, you know, cult, it's if you cut your hair, you're marked for the rest of your life. So that's fine. If you come out as a gay man in that religion, you are marked, and it's probably worse, you know, than actually being a woman and cutting your hair. I mean, it's like one of the worst things you can do. Yeah. So my parent, no, I mean, I did come out later to my parents. I came out way later in life. And I told them and they ignored it and they just basically acted like it was a phase and it wasn't real. And, you know,
I think it must be difficult to have such conflicting emotions when you're growing up. Around, you know, how you identify and who you are and thinking that there's something wrong with you when there obviously isn't. And one of the things I found heartbreaking the other day when I was speaking to an ex-Jehovah's Witness was a man who was growing up in his faith who had realized that he didn't even know what the word was for a long time until one service where they started talking about homosexuality. And then he realized that there were different words to identify with himself, how he was feeling. And then he was so worried about what would happen to him and how people would see him that he just decided that he would marry a woman, but just stay in the church. Which I just thought was so heartbreaking. And there must be thousands of people in their respective faiths that do that, that just say, okay, well, it's easier for me to just, you know, be somebody else than to walk away from all my family and friends. And yeah, it was a really, heartbreaking story. He's not in the movement anymore. And he is happily engaged. So that's awesome.
Well, that's good.
But at the time, it must be so difficult to just resign yourself and go, well, I'll just marry a woman and keep everyone else happy and they don't need to know. But it's, it's just unfortunate that these.
It was very confusing because they would always talk about men being gay, but they never talked about women. And I would get like, I was kind of confused. Like, I don't know if this is okay or not, or like, because, and then I was like, maybe I'm just confused because for a while I didn't think women could be, you know, when I was younger, like I was just like, well, maybe, you know, like I'm just confused. This not a thing that women do.
And You mentioned in your emails to me that you were asked to sign a contract at the age of 14 as well. And that was around, I think that was around cutting your hair.
Yeah. So I was in, when I was 14, they started this youth choir in my church. And they had us all sign, like, I guess they called them contracts, but they're not, I mean, they're not like legally binding or anything.
Yeah.
But they were just basically like saying that we would follow the platform rules of like wearing our hair up on Sunday.
Right.
You know, sleeves to the elbow. We could not cut our hair. And then, you know, we agreed that like if we knew anyone had done that, we would tell.
Yeah.
And then if we, you know, so we had to sign this contract, and the girl, like what I was referring to earlier, the girl at my school who noticed that I cut my hair, I guess she told, or whoever told, and she told on me and of my best friend, because we did it together.
Right.
And then, and we had to, if we, you know, we had to sit down for 6 months. That's what they call it, sitting down. You have to sit down. You can't sit on the platform. You have to sit in the audience with your everybody else.
Right. Okay. So they obviously then, the whole congregation knows that you've done something that you shouldn't have
right.
done.
Right.
And you mentioned that it wasn't too long after your step-siblings became involved with your family that you decided to finally take a step back from the church. And I know you mentioned something that happened around when you were the age of 18 with a house raid. So is this your family's reaction to you leaving the church, or is it something that they constructed because they were genuinely worried about you in some way?
I believe that they were worried about me.
Okay.
In their, you know, in their mind of the way that their minds work and whatever. I do believe that they were worried about me. But I think it was very unnecessary. But when I was 18, I decided to move out with my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And me and her met at church, but her family, for whatever reason, her family didn't like follow the rule. Her family would just go to like services.
Right. Okay.
And for whatever reason, I don't know why, we were allowed to hang out, and she was in choir, and her, you know, her family and my family like got along for some reason, and we were allowed to hang out, and I basically lived at her house.
Okay.
So we moved in together, and whenever I told them that I was moving,
yeah,
me and her were moving in together, they took my car. My grandfather cried, and, you know, I cared about him a lot. He was one of the only people that I was very close to. But that was really hard. You know, and so I moved out. They made it very difficult for me to move out. But I did it. I moved out.
Mm-hmm.
And then me and you know, we were 18. We were doing things we were not supposed to be doing, but we weren't drug addicts. We were, you know, we were drinking. I don't know if we have to edit that out later.
No, not at all. You're 18 years old. Are you joking? Yeah. In England, you go to university at 18. Most people, the legal age to start drinking is 18. People over here at 18. Oh my goodness. They just go out all the time. They just go drinking. Yeah. I mean, that's what you do when you're 18. You go out drinking with your friends, you know, you go out dancing and partying.
Right. We were doing stuff we weren't supposed to be doing. Like we were smoking weed. We were, you know, we were drinking, we were having parties, you know, we were, but you know, and one night, Candace left with some guys to go. She went to go get alcohol. And when she came back, I mean, while she was gone, my aunt showed up at our house, and she told me that there was a family emergency. And she told me that, you know, I didn't even grab shoes. Like, I just was like, okay, like, I just got in the car. And then on the way, she was like, on the way to her house, she was just like, the police are going to raid your house. There's going to be a drug bust at your house, like all this stuff. And, you know, I'm 18. I have no life skills. I don't know shit about anything. Like, I don't know shit about life at all. I don't know how cops work. You know, I don't know how any of this works. And so she told me that, and then she was like, we're gonna bring you to your mom's tomorrow in New Orleans. And they did. Like, I got up the next day, they put me in a car, and I went to New Orleans to my mom's. And my mom, they basically made me feel like I was like hiding, you know. And then when I finally talked to my friend, she was just like, we rode around all night, like looking for you everywhere. Like, she was like, we didn't know what happened.
Right. Okay. So she's gone out. Your aunt showed up. She said, no, no, this won't do. This is sinful.
She said that they had a family emergency.
So they remove you from the house. Your friend returns from being out, and she's like, what, where have you gone? She starts to think, you know, something maybe, you know, a little bit darker has happened to you because you've just vanished out of nowhere. She rides around all night looking for you, and you've been taken back to your mum in New Orleans. And then what happens from there? Do you just kind of be like, well, what's the emergency? Can I go home?
Oh no, that's not even, I mean, like, I knew, I was like, I was in trouble. Like, you know, I was in trouble. I don't really know. Like, I just remember feeling like I was in trouble, but it was weird because I was on my own and I was like paying my own bills. But then it was like, you know, I didn't realize that like they had no right to come in and do anything or have, you know, cause I was still so sheltered. You know, I still didn't know how the world worked. You know, I was at my mom's and I got a job at this Starbucks that was close to her house. And I kind of just started doing that. And yeah, I didn't even ask if I could go home. I knew at that point, like, what the deal was, you know, like, I was very mad. I was very angry. I didn't get to speak to my friend for a really long time, and she didn't know what happened to me. And then I got a job, and I just kind of, and you know, when I was working that job, all of the standards of the church and all of that, I had to start following that again because I was stuck living back in my mom's.
Okay.
So I had short hair. I cut all of my hair off because that was the first thing I did when I moved out.
Yep.
You know, that was the first thing I did. I cut all of my hair off. So I had short hair and I was having to go to church there with short hair. And, you know, I couldn't wear pants to work. I was trying to work a job and I had to like wear skirts and all that.
Yeah. You know, yep. So. And how long does it take for you to be like, okay, I'm going now and I'm actually going, like, don't try and bring me back.
It took me about four times to finally get them.
Okay. Well, I'm not surprised, you know, if they're willing to go to those lengths to get you to come back when you're just living in a house independently. What's the big deal? Is it because you're a single woman living with somebody else that's single? Is that the problem?
That they just really promote like staying, you know, you don't leave until it's time for you to get married. Like, you don't leave home until it's, you know, you're going to be with your husband and you're going to make a family. So when I decided to do something differently, it was just a really big thing. And
but there's nothing to say that you're not going to do those things eventually,
right?
Yeah, I mean, what's the rush from your family's perspective? Do they think that I guess I assume that, you know, if you move out whilst you're not married, you know, and you don't have a partner and you're not,
I really,
you're
think
not thinking they, about marriage, they just assume, well, she's moved out now and she's not married, so she's never going to get married.
I think that's, yeah, maybe that's what it was. And, you know, and I don't know. Maybe that's what it was.
So
it's bizarre.
When you mentioned in your emails to me about jail and rehab, are they things that are linked to this first attempt to move away, or are they things that happen in the other three attempts for you to finally get away from the church altogether?
I mean, the other three attempts of me leaving were like, you know, each time my mental health deteriorated, mm-hmm, to the point, mm-hmm, of me finally just, you know, I started doing drugs. And, you know, that, and the thing is when I cut my hair and like when I did all of that, they were already calling me, you know, they were already like treating me that way. Like they were already treating me like I was on drugs.
Right.
And I was doing all of these things and I was, you know, sleeping with all of these men, and I hadn't slept with anyone. I didn't lose my virginity until I was like 23. I already kind of had that.
It's what do they call it? It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy almost, you know. Yeah. They're telling you that you're doing all these things, so you're like, okay, mm-hmm, well, if I'm being punished for them and I'm not doing them, why don't I just go out and actually do them?
Yeah, and that's exactly what I did. And
so, what age is this, do you remember at all, when you started trying recreational drugs?
Basically what happened was after they made me move to New Orleans and everything, I finally ended up, the lady that was my manager at Starbucks, she got a job in the quarter at this hotel, and she brought me with her.
Okay.
And so she started teaching me how to work in restaurants, and she like taught me, she was like, you know, you can make a lot of money doing this. Like this would help you, you know,
yeah,
get out. And so I, with my first paycheck, like I got an apartment.
Yep.
And I left, again. And so in leaving, all of that happened and everything happened. And then Katrina happened.
Oh, okay.
But right before Katrina, my dad was really heavily on me about leaving New Orleans. He came and visited me. He didn't meet my roommates, but I was living with two gay men. And I was like super proud of my little apartment. And he came to visit me and he looked at me and said, "You have got to get out of here."
Right.
You know, and I was like super proud of myself, like super proud of how much I had done, and that I was on my own, and I was like,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, and I was 20. I think I wasn't even 21 yet. I was like 19 or 20,
mm-hmm,
you know, and I was doing all of these things on my own. And he just looked at me and was like, "You have got to get out of here. Like, this is awful." You know,
which is so heartbreaking because you're coming from such a sheltered upbringing. You know, mm-hmm, you haven't had a lot of these worldly experiences. Mm-hmm, you know, and you've got your independence, you've managed to move away from a really restrictive situation with practically no help from anybody, you know, maybe, mm-hmm, these friends outside of the church that you've moved in with, and you know, who have got, you know, helped you with in work and with this apartment, are pretty much the only people that have helped you to gain this independence. But you've had the the forethought to do this yourself. And then your father comes and you're like, look at what I've achieved. And for him to turn around and say that it's no good, that must have been so devastating.
It was. And I tried to do everything I could to prove myself to him. And I was always just a disappointment. And so, he finally talked me into coming home. I was like, I will come home and just see how it goes. And I came home and it was just, I ended up he made all these promises and he didn't fulfill any of them to get me to come home. Mm-hmm. And then I got stuck living with my grandmother in central Louisiana again. And then I got a little job at some call center and I started hanging out with these people that were heavily doing opiates.
Right.
And I didn't know at the time, I really just once again, not educated, so I tried it with them. And it was like the first time I tried it, it was like I closed the door on everything.
Yeah.
All of that stuff just like went away.
Okay.
And then I was able to just basically sleep through all of it, and I would just, and it got to the point where I was just like, basically sedating myself.
Yeah.
And I was just sleeping through everything because they wouldn't let me leave. Every time I would completely get on my own, like I would go from nothing and like completely get on my own, they would come and just like, they would just completely interrupt my whole life and mm-hmm. all of the work that I had done. And I was like already so behind in life. And I felt like this is just all my life is going to be. I'm just going to be at my grandma's house taking pills and going to sleep. And I just don't want to do this. I don't want to be here. This is what my life is going to be now, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so my grandmother, so there was a point in time where I finally went to my mom and I told my mom, I was like, I need help. My parents didn't even know what I was doing. They didn't know what I was doing.
And it's interesting that they are so adamant that you're going to be with them. But then when you're there physically, they're not even taking any notice of you being there to notice these things that have happened.
They knew that I was doing something. Like they knew that I was like drinking and I was like not in the church and I was like, whatever. They knew that. And I was like, every day fighting with my poor grandmother, putting her through hell.
I was gonna ask if they would say like, why are you doing this to us? Or why are you rebelling against your faith? You're breaking our hearts and things, because narcissism often comes with these types of experiences and movements, I find.
Right. And I mean, I did. I put her through hell. I put my aunt that lived with us, I put them through hell. I was, if I didn't have what I needed to have because I was sick, I was really hard to deal with, So I finally got to the place where I didn't want to do it anymore, but I couldn't stop because I was sick.
Yeah.
All the time, and I went to my mom and I told her, and she brought me to a mental hospital, but they help you find a rehab or whatever. So they put me in there and it didn't go very well. I ended up signing myself out. They ended up having to come get me.
Right.
And they were very upset about it. And then, that kind of alerted them to like what I was doing. that kind of alerted them to, okay, this is what's going on. And I think it was more about, once again, everyone else knowing.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah,
me actually getting better and clean. Like, it wasn't it for them. It was more they were doing the things that they were doing because they were having to explain to people what was going on with me.
Rather than, you know, actually putting you as a priority and your health as a priority.
Right. And so it got ugly because they didn't know what to do with me. You know, they didn't know what to, how to handle it, or, and so it just got ugly, and so the first time they put me in jail, my grandmother found out she had leukemia, and my grandmother had to have surgery.
Right.
And I was working, and I was at work, and whenever I came home from work, my uncles, who they're not my uncles, they're actually my cousins. I just call them my uncles because they're older, but my friend brought me home from work, and we pull up at the house, and there's like all these cars in the driveway, and I go in, and my uncles are there in uniform, because they all are part of, you know, they're all head of narcotics and different parishes and everything around. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
So they basically tell me that I don't live there anymore. And they're like, the SWAT team is on their way. If you have anything in your room, you need to tell us now before they get here.
The SWAT team.
Oh, yeah. They tell me that they're like, you know, and I'm begging them to not do this. I'm just like, please don't do this. Like, I've been trying to stop, you know, and like, they're just like, we want to know why you're doing this. Like, they kept grilling me and like asking me all these questions and like just all this stuff. And then my uncle arrested me. Brought me to, they had a canine in the house, in my grandma's house. They arrested me, brought me to jail, put me in a room, and then some detective came and talked to me, and he told me, he was like, I don't know what your family's trying to do. He was like, it seems like they're trying to just teach you a lesson in scary.
Absolutely.
He was like, it's going to be rough. You're going to have, they found whatever they had, the stuff that they found was like very, very old paraphernalia, very old paraphernalia. And yes, like, I will admit, like, yes, I was doing things that I shouldn't have been doing, but,
You're not selling narcotics to the thousands. So why are they threatening you with the SWAT team? Surely that was just that was a big lie.
I never saw a SWAT team. I just But it was just like,
and the dog is something that they have access to through their positions. Oh yeah,
because they were at one of them. Goodness.
That's such an abuse of power.
Oh yeah, so. Then my grandmother, I mean, my uncle, so the detective tells me that he's like, it's going to be a rough night. You know, he was like, they're going to put you in. And he was like, but in the morning, he was like, I will personally come and get you.
Okay.
I will personally get you out of here.
Okay, so at least you had one person advocating for you and kind of telling you how it was and
right,
and letting you know, sort of, that it's going to be okay.
Right. So I go, they put me in, and then they put me in a dorm with like 30 other women. My Sunday school teacher was the one that put me in there.
Oh my goodness.
So yeah, I mean, like, there's that church is so big that they run everything in that town. It doesn't matter. Like, there's connections everywhere in everything that you do. So, or anything that you're involved in or anywhere that you're at.
Oh my goodness. And it's people, all people wonder why they, some people are like, oh, I don't understand how people can stay in a cult or go back to a cult. Why don't you just leave? And you're just giving everybody so many real examples of why it's not that easy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you've literally just been dragged off to stay in a cell overnight.
Mm-hmm.
By people who just happen to be in positions to be able to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're some kind of drug cartel member.
Oh yeah.
And obviously, so, you don't know any better at this point. You haven't been watching TV or movies your whole life, or you know, or have been around people that are members of the drug cartel, or you know. Oh, that's
so. You know, so they put me in there the next day. They come, they get me out. Well, they didn't get me out. They just pull me out of the dorm.
Right.
And they bring me to the front, and the detective's there, and he brings me in the room. He's like, hey, he's like, look, he was like, I don't know. He was like, the judge is here to talk to you.
Oh my goodness.
And he was like, you're kind of in his hands now. Your parents have talked to him. Like, they've all talked, and there's nothing that I can do. It's like, there's nothing I can do to help you.
Gosh.
So the judge comes in next, and he talks to me. He asked me a bunch of questions. Basically, my dad and my dad's family told him that I had been doing drugs since the age of 14.
Oh, my goodness. You were signing contracts at 14 to not cut your hair.
Yeah.
Right. Oh.
So basically the judge, and like everything, you know, at this point I'm the prisoner. Anything that I say, I just sound crazy, you know, and how am I going to tell this man I'm part of this whole thing and this is what's going on? You know, like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. You know, yeah. It's you against everybody, isn't it?
Right. And it's, and those people that live there in that town, like, they know about that. Those people that are everywhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, he basically in the end told me that I could either, he didn't believe anything that I said. And he basically told me that I could either sit in jail until my court date, and he would set my bond at 100 grand.
Oh gosh. Okay.
Or I could go to rehab.
Okay.
So I said, well, I'll sit here, because I was pissed.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, rebellious, and I was,
yeah,
you know,
sick of everybody telling you what you can and can't do.
So I was like, no, I'm good. I'll sit here. And like, I'm not going to rehab. Like, I'm not doing it. I'm trying. And, you know, and it's that you just don't want to cooperate with anything that they want you to cooperate with. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
So I sat in there for about a week, and then, you know, talking to my family on the phone, and my, you know, my mom just being like, just go to rehab, you know. And so finally I gave in and I went to rehab.
Yeah.
But I sat in jail for 3 weeks, and then I went to rehab. As soon as I got out, I immediately, you know,
relapsed.
Yeah, immediately.
Yeah.
And that was, they did that to me twice.
And at what point did you make the decision to move away from drugs?
I was probably 20. Three, and I met a man who was my drug dealer, and he you know, and me and him had a relationship, and it got to the point where I was sick either way.
Yeah.
And I just got to the place where I was just like, I can't do this anymore.
Okay.
You know, like, I can't do this. Like, I can't, you know, and so I told him that I wanted to start going to the methadone clinic.
Okay.
And so I started going to the clinic, and yeah, so that's how I kind of ended up not doing that anymore.
Okay. Okay.
And then I found out I was pregnant and I had my child, and that kind of solidified me staying clean. I've been clean now for 12 years.
Congratulations. That's amazing. That's great. That's really, really good news.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, you know, and that was the whole thing with all of that. And sometimes I think back on it, and some days are easier than others when I think about it. Like, some days I'm like, you know, they just really didn't know what to do with me. Like, they just really didn't know. But I don't think they had to do that.
No.
I just don't believe that they needed to go that route with me. I was cooperative. You know, I just wanted to sleep through it all. I just wanted to be left alone.
And it would be difficult to know, sort of, I guess it's almost like the chicken or the egg question. Like, what happened first? Was it the continuous being, you know, the continuous pulling back into the church that caused you to be open to having these experiences that would later on have your family put you in jail? Or, you know, would you have ended up being surrounded by those people that gave you the opportunity to try drugs in the first place without being in the church? I mean, it's hard to know. But at the same time, like, where's your education? Like you said, where's your, who's telling you the do's and don'ts of different things? And not just don't do drugs because it's a sin against God, you know, like, genuinely, like, you know, don't take MDMA because you don't know if it's MDMA. Like, don't take these mushrooms because you don't know if they're going to be lethal mushrooms or if they're going to be hallucinogenic mushrooms. That's not the type of education they're giving you. They're just telling you this is bad, and this is why it's bad, because it's in the Bible that it's bad.
Right. And whenever you start doing drugs, it's never that, like, dare the dog moment. It's never like that, do you want some drugs? You know, it's never that way.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's just like, they just really left me out and really did not teach me anything.
It's a difficult one, that, isn't it? I mean, it's because when it comes to things like personal decisions, it's hard to say, well, it's their fault. It's their fault that I started doing these things, or became the way I did, or became difficult to deal with, or they didn't know what to do with me, and that's my fault, you know, and that's their fault. Sorry. But at the same time, like, in these situations, I think you need to take some personal accountability, but I don't know if you would have found yourself in that situation if you weren't subjected to all of this emotional abuse whilst you were growing up. You know, you've already said to yourself, and, you know, to the listeners, that you were looking for some type of escapism from it all. You just wanted it to just stop. And that, and that was an immediate, you know, almost gratifying way that you managed to achieve that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I just had an interview with somebody yesterday as well, whose interview is going to be released a week after yours. And he had a glorious beard that he'd grown now that he's not in the church. And he was talking about his experiences with LSD and how when he tried LSD for the first time, he had such an experience that's what finally made him realize that he didn't need to be in the church anymore. You know, he had some type of trip on this LSD
that allowed him to disconnect himself from everything he'd been taught. And, and, you know, and he said that he was terrified growing up. And sometimes he still does think that if he does something, he's going to hell. Occasionally he'll have those thoughts and those doubts. So it was interesting, the conversation that we had around narcotics yesterday. And then I just had to say that any of the listeners who are thinking about trying recreational drugs should do their research and be very careful before they do, because, you know, we're sitting here and you're like, yeah, I managed to shut the world out, and he's sitting there like, oh man, LSD, it was great. And then I'm sitting here like, please, listeners, if you're gonna try drugs, just be really careful. We're not advocating for drug use at all. We're just, you know, do your research and know the sources that you're using and all that stuff.
It is interesting, because I recently did LSD for the first time. I waited a very long time to do it because of my upbringing. I was really scared to do it. My parents always taught me, like, my parents made me scared of my subconscious.
Right.
I just wanted to, like, face that fear, and I did it. And I basically learned that I'm not scared of myself as much as I thought I was, you know, and that's interesting that he had the same experience. Like, I really, like, and I'm even more, like, separated from it now. Since that experience. Yeah.
So when we talk about Pentecostalism, and I mentioned this in my chat yesterday as well, that people often think about snake handling, they associate snake handling with Pentecostalism. But I was talking to Sam yesterday, and we agreed that that's kind of like the very fringy side of, an intense kind of, like, on the outskirts in really, really small rural places. But there's definitely
churches in Louisiana that do it. I've heard of people being injured. I've heard of some crazy stuff, but none of the churches I went to practice that, but I have heard of it.
And when you're going through all this stuff with your family around, you know, them not knowing what to do with you, were you ever kind of subjected to having a demon cast out of you?
No, they did send me to talk to this lady that's a therapist.
Right.
She's from Malaysia, I believe, and she grew up as, like, a Hindu witch, apparently. So that's her niche, I guess.
Right. Like,
because it's weird with her, because, like, she's allowed to, like, be a speaker at a lot of things. Like, she's almost borderline a preacher, and so that's really weird because they don't really allow that. But with her, I guess they probably make a lot of money off of that, or they get a lot of more of a following because of her.
Right.
And they did have me go and talk to her a few times, and she did, like, have some prophecies that were weird, but, like, they did that, but, like, there was no, like, exorcism, any kind of thing like that. No,
it's weird. I've never been to Louisiana, but I've watched True Blood.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Shreveport before, so I was just wondering if that's actually, like, and I'm just picturing this woman that lives kind of, like, by a lake and has a cabin, and the cabin has, like, alligator skulls hanging from it, and you're going to her and she's like, I have a prophecy. But I don't know if that's kind of more voodoo or
no, but that's a lot cooler than how it actually was.
Okay. And what about speaking in tongues and things like that? Is that something that you experienced?
Yes. So And I feel like every one of us that have left the church, this is like the one thing that we like are so embarrassed to talk about, but whatever. So when I was growing up, all of the kids were getting it at really young ages. Like everybody was getting it when they were like 6 and 7 years old. I got it later, and I got it when I was like 8 or 9, and that was like old.
Right.
Like that was like, that was old for getting it. I got it at Children's Revival. And I just remember thinking in my head, like, I'm so tired of doing this. Like, I'm so tired of like every altar call, like I have to go up, because I am kind of an introvert in a way. I don't like there to be a lot of attention on me. So like that was really nerve-wracking for me, the way that they go about doing it. Like when they're trying to get you to speak in tongues, like it's a big thing. There's a lot of people around. Yeah. And so I was like tired of going through that part of it. So I finally just like faked it. And I thought to myself, like, you'll get it later. And then, you know, like that's kind of what I thought in my little 9-year-old brain. Like, just pretend and then you'll get it later and then it'll be fine. And, you know, as time went on, I like kept faking it and I just like never actually got it. And I was just like, when is this going to actually happen? And like, then I kind of got to the place where I was like, kind of looking at other people, like looking around at other people, like, like, you know, like, why, like, are you doing the same thing, like, as I am? Like, what are we doing? Like, you know, I kind of had those thoughts, like, I wonder if they faked it too. And I wonder if, like, there are other people here that are faking it with me. But
and when, but you, yeah, like when you said that there are, you know, there are people that are embarrassed, it's the one thing you're embarrassed to all talk about. I guess you have had that conversation with people where they've been like, yeah, well, I was faking it as well.
Oh, yeah. And it's just, and like, and even my sister, like, because even me and my sister, even though we don't have a good relationship now, we have had conversations about this. And, you know, because she's left too. And, you know, we've talked about it, and like she's told me, she's like, you know, growing up, she was like, you never sold out. She was like, you were always like on the fence. Like you were always like, I'm not doing that. Like, you know, and she was just like, you never really sold out. Cause I would ask her about it. You know, I was like, what did you like, how did you feel when you had to do that? Like, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm not going to share like her thing, but like, you know, she told me, cause I told her mine and I was like, I just knew, like, I didn't know it was fake. I was just like, I'll get it later.
That's so funny.
She was like, you just never really fully, she was like, I don't ever remember a time where you fully believed in this.
No, no. It's interesting as well, because you said that most kids are doing it at the age of 6 or 7. Like most kids have just really grasped the English language or their respective language at the age of 6 or 7, you know. My son's 1 year old now, I have a 1 year old and he's like making sounds and copying sounds that you make, but he's not saying words. So could he pass as speaking in tongues? Like so it's almost, you know, like you make these noises, then you learn to speak, then you go back to just making these strange noises that are supposed to pass as some language somewhere in the universe where someone will understand you because you're speaking a biblical language.
Right. And it's interesting. The other thing that happens too is they do this thing where like someone will stand up like in the middle of the preaching or singing or whatever's going on. Someone will stand up and loudly start speaking in tongues, like very like there's a message. And then at my church that I primarily grew up in, not the tinier. I mean, it did happen in the tinier churches too, but in the church that I primarily grew up in, the preacher's mom would interpret the message.
Oh my goodness. See, oh, yes. this is, I think, and that reminds me of the opening of True Blood, actually, when they would show like weird, like those types of places, you know, like church services where everybody's convulsing and they have their arms up in the air and they're speaking in tongues, you know, or making strange noises. And I think that is an image that is often associated with religious cults. I think that's what people think of. They think of people, this mass hysteria of people standing mm-hmm. in this room, sort of piling up on top of each other on the floor and writhing around on the floor and looking seizures. It's really kind of, if you don't understand it, like for me to look at those types of things from an outsider's perspective, it's really quite creepy to watch.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is. And I have the theory of like, you know, what I think is happening in church is that it's all so emotional, like the whole thing, you know, you go, you get a new outfit to wear. You got to be on point with your outfits. You know, that was a whole thing. I don't know how it is now, but I can remember growing up and it was like a whole thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you spend hours getting ready, you go to church and the music is emotional, you know, everything about the whole experience is so emotional and they just have so much control and they know how to speed it up and slow it down. And they mm-hmm. know how to, I mean, I've been in services where people are laying on the floor, like drunk on the Holy Ghost. You know, I've been to services where a woman stood up in the middle of service and said she got her hearing back, right. You know, but like, you know, and the thing about this whole, us talking about this is that, you know, they do say that the Holy Ghost is a gift. They do say that not everybody gets to have it. So maybe I don't get to have it. You know, I could be completely wrong about this whole thing. You know, maybe I don't get to have the gift.
I say this in so many different episodes as well. I've spoken to so many different people from so many different movements, sects, religions, groups, whatever word you want to apply to whichever subject we're talking about. But I often ask them, what if your movement is the one, you know, because they all preach and they all say that this is the true movement. This is right. the one thing that can save you. Everything else is a lie. Nothing else is the truth. You know, when I speak to Jehovah's Witnesses, Jehovah is absolute. There is nothing else. So mm-hmm. anybody else that says that there is, that's not truthful. So I always wonder if one day it's going to be one of these groups of people that I've spoken to or spoken about, and they're going to be the ones that are saved, and it's going to be all the others that aren't saved. And I just,
that would be so crazy for you.
But because they all say the same thing, they all have the same message. They're all saying, you know, like, we are the chosen ones. We are the truth. So it's just interesting to me. We're all special. Yeah,
that's
exactly.
What they tell you.
And so I just wonder if one of these days one of them's going to end up being right. You know, one of them's going to end up being truthful. But I'm just going to keep making these episodes until that day comes. You know, let's see how many of these groups we can get through before mm-hmm. that happens. So I am going to ask you one more question here on my notes before I hand over to you and ask you if you think there's anything we've missed. And that is, do you have any advice for people who are thinking about or trying to leave their own movement or church?
I would say that, you know, take your time. Don't try to do too much at once. Listen to your gut instinct, and also, like, your journey doesn't have to be exactly like someone else that left. You know, like, your journey is going to be completely different, and it's going to be your own. And also, you have to do all of the work to leave on your own. Like, no one can do it for you. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to do all of the work on your own. But yeah, that's would be my only advice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it's a good piece of advice as well, to kind of get prepared to do things on your own, especially because a lot of these movements and practices will practice shunning. So if you're not in the same frame of mind or mentality that your friends and family are, and that's all you've known whilst you're growing up, there's a chance that you're going to be doing this without the support of anybody else. And once you have made that move out of your church or faith or movement, that you're not going to have those friends and family to speak to or lean on anymore, because, you know, you've decided a different path. So I think that what you said there about, you know, you'll have to do it on your own is definitely something that people should have in mind. But a lot of the time, I suppose people already know this, and that's what's keeping them there in the first place. They know that once they make that decision to go, they're going to lose those relationships and those ties. But you have to ask yourself, like, what do you want out of this life at the end of it? Because if you want a life that you have built for yourself, and you want to experience things that you're not able to do so in your current capacity, then, you know, you have to think about the balances and you know, what's going to be best for you. So yeah, definitely. I think what you've said there about understanding that you're going to do it on your own is definitely something that people should consider. So that's all my questions. I've gone through our little list. I've scratched off all of our points here. So I just wondered if there was anything that you wanted to add, or anything you think we've missed before we finish the call today.
No, I don't think so. We talked about a lot.
We have gone through a lot. And I just wanted to let you know that I'm so grateful for you to come here and trust me with your story, especially talking through, you know, themes that are probably quite difficult for you in terms of the experiences that you had with your family and some of the things that they put you through. And I know that can't be easy to relive or go back through. So I'm just really appreciative of that. I know that this story will help others who are thinking about, you know, moving out of the church or moving out of their own group. So thank you so much for your time today, Courtney. I'm really excited to show this episode to the listeners.
Me too. Thank you for doing this, because it does, in a way, it is kind of therapeutic. And it also helps us organize it, so that when other people have questions, I can just be like, you can go listen to this thing. And like, that, and that's all that you need, you know, like, it's easier for me to just do that, because you get so tired of meeting new people and talking.
Yeah, and having to explain, you know, the you know, I often have people say that they find friendships and relationships hard because they're so guarded, or they overshare, or they don't commit to a friendship or a relationship, or they overcommit because of all of these experiences that they've had growing up. Or they say, you know, oh, I can't come to dinner because I've got therapy. And they're like, oh, you're in therapy, what are you in therapy for? And then I'm like, oh, well, it's a really long story. So go and listen to this episode where you can listen to all of it. So yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Courtney, for your time today, and I hope you're welcome. You enjoy the rest of your day. I'll speak to you soon.
Okay,
thanks. Bye.
That is the end of this week's episode. If you'd like to get in touch, you can do so by finding me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or Twitter and Instagram at cultvaultpod. I'm your speaker, Casey, and this has been the Cult Vault.